Thank you for being here. And thank you for...
Thank you for inviting me, Nico.
Yeah, we are really, really glad that you're with us. We met at the European Congress for Hematology in Vienna, where you came to my poster. And since then, we kept in contact. And I'm really, really glad that you are here with us. And maybe...
Thank you so much.
We start a little bit about yourself, so that you introduce yourself, who you are, where you work, and then we go from there, okay?
Okay, so my name is Abdul Muqtadir Abbasi, and I'm 33 years old. And I was born in Pakistan, in its capital city, it's known as Karachi. And it has like a population of around 22 million. Just my city. It's a big metropolitan, and we have a big population. It's basically along the seashore. So we have a port as well in Karachi, and all of our country's economic activities also through our city. And obviously it's a big city, so you know, big city problems, big city good things, everything is here. I did my schooling here in St. Patrick's and St. Paul's English High School, which were missionary schools. And then I did my medical school, which is known as Dow Medical College. And this is an old school. Old school means it was like before the independence of Pakistan. It was inaugurated by one of the British, I think he was a governor here or something like that. His name was Dow, so it's Dow Medical College. And so it was like 5 year med school, then 1 year of internship, and then I did my 2 years of internal medicine training, after which I had to give an exam, which is known as the intermediate module exam. And then I had like 3 years of straight clinical hematology training. After that, obviously, we had to give the exit exam. And that is conducted by a body which is known as the College of Physicians and Surgeons Pakistan. So it's more like on the format of the UK Royal College. We have a similar degree known as the Fellow of the College of Physicians and Surgeons, just like Fellow of Royal College. So it's sort of the same format, but unlike the UK, it's not sort of a degree that you can do any time, or maybe it's a bit different. That is sort of an exit exam. So only after you complete up, like just like the CCT and specialty certificate. I did that, and then I just went to the Congress in Vienna and also gave my EHA exam, which was a good exam, and sort of it was a nice experience there as well, meeting new people. I think that's it for my education. Yeah.
And how was it that you got into hematology? Was it something you were always interested in, or was it something?
Yes, it's a good question. Basically, in my med school, honestly, very honestly, I had no idea everyone is hearing about cardiology, nephrology, pulmonology, you know, hematology is like something very, it's not that rare, but like people are not usually into it.
That's so, the same with me.
Yeah. So even in internship, there was no rotation for hematology for me. And we had like 3 months in medicine, then 3 months general surgery. Then I did 3 months of burn surgery as well. And I did 3 months of nephrology. Interestingly, during my med school, I did two electives. I went to Harvard University for cardiology in my final year, and I went for plastic and reconstructive surgery at Oxford John Radcliffe Hospital. So just for the sake of, you know, getting exposure of different systems and learning and see what my interest is. So after I did my internship, I don't know. I found there was a job for a medical officer in one of the institute where I specialized. It's known as the Aga Khan Hospital. It is one of the like JCIE accredited hospital and CAP accredited laboratory. And so at that time, so there was a position in oncology. And I just said, okay, let's see. I had no idea, no experience about it. And I went to it. So I was amazed to see, like, the first time I went there, I just did my internship and I was on call one night as a medical officer. And then I went into, so there were private rooms of the patients. And I went into one of the rooms and the attendant said that the patient's TLC count is 315,000. So I said, I think you're mistaken. It's not the WBC count, it's the platelets. So I had no idea, honestly, of having some. I mean, you've read in the books, but practically you're not expecting anyone to say like 300,000 WBC count. But that was like my first hit of what hematology is about. And then, you know, you see then different patients, then a lot of things then you have. So it was my, those 6 months of exposure to heme, basically heme malignancies. And from there, I said, no, I think this is something that I should go into that interests me. The hospital I trained at, specialized, they have the hematologist is seeing all benign diseases, all malignant diseases, and bone marrow transplant. And so obviously we had adult hematology separate, peds hematology separate. They have their own team. Their own everything, the ward is separate, everything is separate. So it's more or less, so if you see the big hospitals, they have proper hematologists seeing, so basically hemo-oncologists, they're seeing benign and malignant hematology. And so it's, there are very few people who are actually, you know, they're very specialized into a particular thing. Like thalassemia is one of the, it's like around 5 to 8% of the population that is affected by thalassemia. So we have some people who are really into like just doing thalassemias, and they're very, very, they're doing a great job. Obviously because they're focused into something, but in general, the hematologists, they are looking at the benign and the malignant as well as bone marrow transplants. So some people are obviously they're focusing more into transplants. So they're going, although we don't have a recognized training in bone marrow transplant, but like there are hospitals that are doing their own hospital-based trainings for the 1 year or 2 year trainings in bone marrow transplants. So yes, that's about it.
And what is access to transplant like for patients in Pakistan? Is it limited to specific big hospitals and?
Yeah, so transplant is, so we have like, I would say there are private hospitals in the big cities, like Aga Khan Hospital, right? That's a big tertiary care hospital that's based in Karachi, and it is doing transplants, allo, auto, everything. But it is a private institute, and so you have to have, the patient has to have the amount to bear for the transplant. However, for some people of certain provinces, their governments, if we like prepare a letter for them, and you know, they can apply there and they can get grants for the whole transplant. So it's like if it's the general cost is like 4 million, like 4 million rupees. So I don't know how to, you know, I don't know what the cost in dollars or pounds, but it's like 1 rupee, 200, it's around 200 rupees is to $1. So about 4 million rupees. So the one option is that. The other is there's an institute is also known as Shaukat Khanam Memorial Hospital. And that's a total charity based hospital. And it's also JCIE accredited hospital. They are also doing transplants. They're more mostly focused on pediatric leukemias because obviously they have good prognosis and everything. So they're not putting people's donors' money into patients who have bad prognosis. That doesn't seem nice, but obviously it's more practical to you know, sort of spend the money at places where you have a better prognosis. And then there are certain institutes that are being run by the armed forces in Pakistan, and they are doing because they have good amount of money into it. So there's an armed force institute in one of the cities. It's a big hospital, and they are doing bone marrow transplants and everything. But the problem, it's a sort of a problem, or we can say it's a developing thing in Pakistan. So it's like we only have those in the main cities. So like 4 or 5 main cities of Pakistan, they're doing bone marrow transplants. So people who are living in the peripheries, they have to come to the main cities. They need to have that amount of funding, or maybe they can get it arranged by the governments. But usually those people who need transplant, they usually get a transplant. Somehow they get it arranged from the government or by arranging themselves, and they usually get a transplant. Yeah.
All right. So you pointed out some things we need to ask you about. First of all, I would like to highlight, so you live in a city with more than 20 million. Is that correct?
Yeah. Around 22 million.
22 million. Okay. But there are only like few hospitals providing transplant. Is that also correct?
Yeah, that's very true.
Okay.
Just to make
the comparison complete with European views and how other realities look like. And then my other question would be, because you alluded to the pediatric setting, do you also cover both, like adults and pediatrics, or is that like a separate, completely separated in your clinical practice?
Usually it's separated, but again, now there are some people, like we in hematology, you have two options in clinical hematology. Either you come with a medicine background or you come with a pediatric background. So if you have a pediatric background, then you have, like, you're more comfortable dealing with pediatric patients. To be honest, I'm very uncomfortable dealing with pediatric patients. And we had some of these patients when I used to rotate in the bone marrow transplant. It was, you know, in adults, we like, it's every dose is in our memory. You know, we have to be like, we're open on this dose. But for child, for every age, for everybody, you have to like calculate each and every dose for each patient. And that gets very difficult. Then in turn, also that vitals are also very different for different ages. You have different blood pressures that are hypertension. So I remember patients who or on cyclosporines, we have this in mind that, okay, if this is the blood pressure, the patient is going hypertensive. But in children, the pressures are very, the ranges are very different. So I don't know, maybe it seems difficult to me as an adult hematologist, but maybe our pediatric hematologist would be better able to tell this. But yes, it's usually different. Like people are different, we are different. But sometimes, like in people who are doing transplants, obviously, a lot of patients in transplant are pediatrics. So they usually get experience in both of them. And so they're seeing both of them. But with time, when we are getting more hematologists on board, and there are pediatrics also and adults also. So obviously, when we have a lot of people, we can usually divide the burden and, you know, give a better care, because obviously a pediatrician would be a better person to do that.
I completely agree to that statement.
So if she can add, if our pediatric hematologist can add about the doses, is it like we feel it that way, or is it you also feel it that way?
No, it is one of those things. And sometimes you're just like, but I think we just get used to it. So, and then you also, the commonly prescribed things, the dose per kilo or per meter squared is in your head, so it's a bit less. Although you have to get your calculator out, you don't necessarily have to look up things quite so often when you get used to them all.
Yeah, that's true.
What's it like in terms of access to clinical trials and things? Do you have many patients treated on trials?
No, not really. That I think this is something we is something challenging for countries like ours. And there are people who are doing these things, but clinical trial, they are very, we had some clinical trials, but they are not as common as we see in Europe or in UK, maybe in the US. It's very common, but in our setups, we do have trials, but they're very, because we have to go, obviously, we have our own different issues and funding issues, like people even can't afford the simple, simple procedures that are very common. So going into a clinical trial and all those things, usually they get very difficult, to be very honest. Yeah.
And the whole system in Pakistan, you said there are private hospitals, hospitals who are funded by the army or the armed forces. So can you structure that a little bit that we understand? So what does the healthcare coverage look like in Pakistan?
Okay, so basically, there are government hospitals in general. I'm not talking just about hematology, but in general, we have some government hospitals. But to be very honest, I would not be very happy with going and get treated there. There are lack of facilities, there are lack of medicines, there are a lot of issues. With few exceptions, obviously, there are few hospitals, few government hospitals, government-run hospitals, that are doing a good job. And then there are a lot of alumni that are coming out from different colleges, just like my college, and then they think of building a particular department in a government hospital and providing the facilities. But I would say it's suboptimal, to be very honest, the facilities in the government hospitals. I mean, I would not want to get treated there or maybe take my family. But obviously, for people who can't afford, they have people living below poverty line and those people. So at least they have some sort of facility where they can go in emergency and get treated. Then there's no insurance system as such in Pakistan as well. Like, there's no concept of health insurance. The insurance companies providing the options of going to different hospitals. So it's basically like the model is working like on the like it's just you have to pay for your own thing, and honestly that gets difficult a lot of time, because the treatment is getting very expensive day by day, and the people's income it's not increasing that much. I would say it's a suboptimal facilities in the government hospitals. And then there are institutes that are being run by, for example, the armed forces. So they are mostly focused on their own communities, and then they're also serving the civilians, but it's limited to a particular aspect. But yes, in terms of getting advancements and everything, because they have a better funding, they usually get into they are available to get facilities, have good structures, and introduce different things. So in a way, it's good that at least something is coming in the country by some means. Yeah.
And in terms.
Yeah, sure.
Sorry. In terms of training, does that take place within the government hospitals, or can you train in any type of hospital?
Okay, as I told you, there's a body. It's the College of Physicians and Surgeons Pakistan. It's an independent body. It's not a government body. Sort of semi-government, but it's independent body. And it's looking after all those requirements of the hospitals for starting a training, for adequate supervisors, adequate beds, adequate patient availability, load, everything. So they basically, approve hospitals across the board, whether it's government hospitals, armed forces hospitals, private hospitals. They just need to fulfill their requirements of particular beds in the hospital, of having, for example, if there are three or four supervisors needed or whatever, if they fulfill the requirement, any hospital can facilitate and start the training as well.
And how about to just maybe go a little step back? So how long does it take you to finish med school? And the other one is, how do you get into med school? Is it very competitive in Pakistan? Or
yeah, it is competitive. It's like so again, when we come to medical med schools, which we usually call as medical colleges here, so it's like then again you have private medical college and government medical colleges. So Dow Medical Colleges, for example, is a government medical college, and it's like if you enter into the medical college as on merit. So I was like, when I applied there, it was a competitive exam. There were like thousands of students applying for like 100 seats or 200 or 300 seats. So that is almost like, it's very, very cheap. And the government bears the expenses of making you a doctor. And that's something very good and to be appreciated. And then there are private medical colleges that are insanely expensive. But they have also, limited seats. So it's obviously competitive, but when you, it becomes more competitive when you're thinking of going into a government med school and, getting a cheaper way out of this. Because med school gets very expensive if it's not government medical college. So yeah, and then it's like 5 years of med school, in which still year three you are more mainly focused in your academics, and from year three, four, five, the last 3 years, they're mostly you go in different wards, you get exposure to different, like pediatrics, medicine, cardiology, and everything, so like that. So it's like 5 years. After completion of 5 years and you clear your MBBS, you have you get a provisional license to go through an internship program. That is a 1 year internship that you have to rotate in medicine and surgery, and one of the minors of medicine and surgery as per your requirement or whatever you want. And after you complete that 1 year of internship, then you get a full license to practice. Yeah.
And what about when we talk about access? So you said those who need a transplant may get one. You obviously have no CAR T, I imagine. What about other treatments? Do you also have like a large generic system, or how does it work when we focus on hematology?
Okay, so when you come to, let me just talk about the CAR T cell therapy, as I also discussed with you when I was there in Vienna. So basically, at one of the institutes which I talked about, Armed Forces Institute in Pakistan, they have sent a couple of people to UK and other places for training, and maybe they'll be starting in the next 2 or 3 years when they have those people trained. But obviously, that would be just one hospital in the whole country that would be starting. But obviously, we'd start from somewhere. But that's a good thing that they're all started and thinking about those things, and they have the funding and they can send people, so it's good to start from somewhere. So a patient who needs a transplant, and he doesn't have money for that, so we, for example, what I trained, that we used to make a detailed summary of the patient, and then we asked them to, for example, go to their government bodies, the local government bodies, and apply there for some sort of a grant. So there are provinces where, so we have like five provinces, five different administrative divisions in Pakistan. So there's some of them, they basically give you the whole grant for the transplant. But I did not actually go through any of the patients that was unable to get money for the transplant. But I suppose there would be, certainly there would be people who would not be able to, you know, or at the first instance, when they listen of the whole cost and everything, they even decide at that point in time that they won't be going for a transplant. But when you compare it with the whole thing, like the whole population and the whole load and everything, certainly things would be compromised.
And other treatments like TKIs, for instance, venetoclax?
So TKI, for example, in CML, the last institute I was practicing in is known as the Indus Hospital, and it's a charity-based hospital. So it was giving, for example, imatinib free of cost to the patients. And whatever the dose, whatever the drug, if the patient is CML, I used to start a lot of patients on imatinib there. And then, for example, so we have, if you talk about CML, so we are usually dealing with imatinib and nilotinib. The other drugs are available, but they're not readily available. And then you have to like go through different means and get it arranged from some, you know, other neighboring country. And then there are people who arrange medicines for it. But the readily available drugs are imatinib and nilotinib. And in imatinib, so there's one hospital that's doing that, but that's just one hospital again who's providing that nilotinib. But then there are the companies like GSK and all those different companies. They are also providing like at 40 or 50% discounted prices. So if the patient is non-affording, we connect them to the official representatives of the companies, and they go there, provide the documents necessary to show that they cannot afford it. And they give like 40-50% discount. Still, it's not that easy. Even after 40-50% discount, it's not that easy. And it's very painful when I am dealing with such patients. And a lot of patients who are, for example, resistant to imatinib, and they're coming to you that they can't afford nilotinib, and I'm just treating them on hydroxyurea. You know, so it gets very like, you feel so helpless about it. Can't do anything. And obviously it's not something like, it's not like 2 months, 3 months course that you can maybe arrange it for them. It's like they have to take for years and maybe for their lifetime. So, and then there are people who are maybe in some rural areas who maybe even die because of some very simple basic diseases due to lack of facilities. So you would be thinking that investing this amount on, you know, providing maybe Tisigna for this patient, I can help like 100 people there out and, you know, get their basic facilities. So sometimes, to be very honest, practicing in Pakistan gets very difficult in terms that it's emotionally very challenging. When, even like, giving someone enoxaparin, I've dealt with like both populations. Like the institution I was trained in, the Ahan Hospital, we used to cater the sort of elite of our country. And the Indus Hospital is a charity-based hospital. It's like the extreme poor people. And so it's very difficult to, you know, practice actually clinic hematology in people who are not affording. It's very difficult. And a lot of times, like, you have to help them out of your own pocket and, you know, get simple drugs, you know, providing them, okay, just buy it. And I remember one of my patients who was like, he was a young kid, like 18 years. He had portal vein thrombosis, and he had like, his APLA antibodies were strongly positive. I couldn't give dox for him. And then he had some issues with his factor 7 as well. So I couldn't give him warfarin as well. So the only option was enoxaparin, and then even he couldn't afford enoxaparin, obviously. So it's like for the next 3 months maybe. So there are a lot of situations where it gets difficult. So it's like it's very there's no standard thing in Pakistan. In somewhere there are some hospitals that are providing you with a lot of things. I like IVIG is very expensive. It's like in 1 million or 2 million rupees in Pakistan. And I got it for one of my ITP patients from my hospital free of cost. He had to go some surgery. He was a CP child basically. So at one place you can even get in a million rupees thing in an instance for free. So there's no standard, no healthcare system as such, but there at different places you have different opportunities. There are good things and bad things, but I would say it's something developing. And anyways, I think clinical hematology and hematology oncology as adults, it is not easy in any country. It's a lot of expense. It is a lot of money you have to invest, and in the end, you don't have a good prognosis. That's the worst thing of all. Like if you, for example, in AML patients, what was the prognosis? Even after you're doing everything, it's like 40%. So I think this is, we have in general, hematology has its own challenges. Especially in developing countries like mine, I think we have come a lot. We have done a lot and we have improved a lot. And there are institutes in Pakistan that are doing like this. An institute is known as National Institute of Cardiovascular Diseases. It's catering thousands of patients with free stents, free pacemakers, free different devices, full CABGs, and everything they're doing it. So a lot of things are coming up, but I would say that, and to be honest, I would not sort of accuse anyone for it, but hematology is something, it is difficult to even explain it to someone that it's difficult to come sort of convince someone to spend a lot of money in something, you know, which doesn't have a good prognosis. So the only thing I can talk about maybe for CML patients, they you know, respond very well with TKIs and a lot of other diseases, or maybe aplastic anemia, getting an ATG, a transplant. I think these are something good. But again, we have some lacking, some good things. It's a mixture basically. But it's a lot of time as a practicing physician when you're catering the poor patients, it gets difficult. But it was in my mind, I wanted to share one patient with you. It's not just like it's a habit of people, you know, talking about lack of facilities and, you know, we don't have that, we don't have this. But I think I just wanted to share because I want to motivate people, you know, you have to like leave your comfort zone and you have to, you know, go out of the way and do something to sort out things. So so there was one when I started, I was just like a fresh graduate from hematology and I joined this hospital. And there was one child, she was 14 years. Now, again, I don't deal pediatrics. But this child was referred to me by the rheumatologist in the hospital, which I shared on the Twitter group as well. So she was a 14 years old child, pancytopenias every other like month, few months, responding very well to steroids. The time the steroids are stopped, she went into bad pancytopenias, fever, blah, blah, blah. So she was finally, she was initially being dealt by pediatric hematologists and pediatric oncologists. Then they did not, you know, they couldn't find something relevant because you don't have the molecular test available in general. NGS has come in, but there are certain companies that are taking samples and sending it to maybe China or US and getting the test done. But in general, we don't have the NGS facility. So, but obviously we can send the sample. That's something you have to like, you know, go out of the way and do it for the patient. So complaining that we don't have this, we don't have that, you can just take a sample and send it. We have aeroplane ships to take the sample to other place, you know, and it can test it. So that patient was being basically managed since last 2 years and they didn't have a diagnosis. The rheumatologist handed over the patient to me. And I initially also, I was sort of a perplexed when I saw that. I said, they have been, the case was discussed in US. I don't know how many places that case was discussed in tumor meeting, tumor boards and everything. And they were suspecting T lymphoproliferative disorder and blah, blah, everything. So then I discussed on Twitter just to have a different opinions. And you guys all said that we should be looking for HLH in that patient. Although interestingly, like she had like 4 to 5 marrows and she had no evidence of any evidence of hemophagocytosis. But the overall response of the patient was like she had some immune problem. So then I talked to the administration of my hospital and I said it's just a $250 test. I want to send this patient sample. And after a lot of documentation and everything, I sent that sample to one of the labs through one of the hospitals to US. And we found out the UNC13D mutation in that patient. And now I have handed over that patient to the to one of the pediatric bone marrow transplant physicians. So to sort of proceed with that patient. But the point over here is just to, you know, motivate people to go out of there. If something is not, there's always some way out a lot of times, which we, if there's something not available directly with you, you can just maybe, I mean, I just took help from Twitter, you know, my colleagues at Twitter, and you know, it's you can just talk to different people. The world is out open to you. You can get your lab test done. You can arrange that small amount of money and sort out the problem for those. So I think hopefully with more young blood and more fresh blood, there'll be more aggressiveness in you know, handling and sorting out the problems. So that's again another solution to bring out younger blood in all the societies, as you mentioned that day as well. That's another issue.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'm always impressed to see how different people are managing different situations, and especially I really like what you said is it's which from a European or let's say rich standpoint would be somehow maybe a bit problematic, but if you say that has a real power to say, okay, well, yeah, there are problems, but let's not focus too much on the problems that exist and just focus on how we solve these problems or how we like make the world a better place just with the little steps what we have, right? So I really, really like that. Maybe two final points. One is, before we get to this trainee issue, do you feel, because you alluded to the problems you have, the differences between each hospital and is there also, do you feel the pressure at the moment? Because we all live in a like quite an intense period at the moment. And we, at least in Germany, our hospitals, we feel the pressure we maybe never felt before. Even during COVID and before that, the most. Do you feel certain problems getting more intense at the moment with all what's going on in the world?
I think it's more of an economic problem. People, you know, when they don't have money in their pocket, it's a big problem. Anyways, because like you have a lot of stresses. Like in life, you have in general, you have a lot of stresses, and when you don't have money in your pocket, that's a big stress again. Especially when you have to like support your own education, you have to support your own health, you know. So it's in general a level of frustration and irritability is increased. So I think it's not more of like in Pakistani population, and you're most welcome when you come to Pakistan, inshallah. Pakistani people are very lively people, to be honest. The challenging situations in which we are living, to be honest, I would say if you bring a European in and you want him to stay here for a month, he would go crazy. You know, the traffic and everything. Mm-hmm. But we, in general, are very resilient people. All the people, even by living in Pakistan, India, and all those regions, highly populated, you know. And I would say you would call maybe it a lower middle income or something, any country. But there are people who are, you know, wealthy rich here. They're truly wealthy rich. A lot of them. That's not the majority, but there are a lot of people. And there's a lot of philanthropy going on here in Pakistan. People are like, it's not usually projected, but the amount of money that is being spent on charity is like, it's enormous. It's huge. It's like in millions of dollars that are being spent by people. So even when people don't have money, they're spending a lot of it on charity. Then we have, like, in Muslims, we have a concept of zakat. It's an obligatory spending that you have to spend your money. Like, if you have like a particular amount of money that you have saved for a year, you have to give like 2.5% of that money for the well-being of poor people. And so people who are, you know, they're wealthy, their 2.5% is a lot. 2.5% of their stored wealth. So, there's another aspect of the zakat system that is helping a lot of people, because the industrialists, the big shots in industry, they have a lot of money coming out as zakat, and that is helping again, because, you know, it's not very easy to donate something. Unless you have any motivation in the background, you know, whether you want fame or maybe it's a religious obligation, then it becomes easy to, you know, spend that money amount, or you have some sympathy. There should be something to motivate you. And this is a big blessing for countries like ours, where you have scarcity of wealth in a majority of people. So that's some helping out something. But yes, again, that's very true what Nico, you have pointed out, that in general, frustration level in people, irritability in people, it is increased. And it's not just the patients, it's the doctors. And it's globally, if you see that, because especially, it may seem sort of philosophical, but that's my observation, that there's a lot of materialism today in this world. And when we see iPhones coming out every new year, and, you know, lavish handbags of thousands of dollars, you know, and glasses of thousands of dollars, and everything, it's a lot of, it's a consumerism concept in today's world. So I think in general, we have a lot of frustration, you know, to earn a big amount. And every other person is in the same line, to be very honest. And the frustration, not just in the patients, it's in the doctors as well. You know, so their own target from sort of, you know, I mean, everyone wants money. That's not something like doctors have to go and buy their own things as well. Nobody's giving them free of cost things that they serve people for free. But to the point that you see patients as customers, this is something which is I see it incoming. Because now hospitals are being run by MBAs from business institutes coming in and telling the hospitals that this is the way you should tackle the patients, rather than the doctors telling, you know, and deciding the thing. So I think it's overall the thinking of the society that is changing. The world has problems since it's starting. I think it's not something new. We have always had problems since the day one of humans. A lot of problems. And they will never end. There's no end to it. But I think in general, I would say that we need to be the change rather than to bring the change. We need to change ourselves. A lot of people, a lot of like juniors, they complain. And every one of you have gone through this process of your seniors maybe insulting you at some point in your training. You're not happy with your supervisors and all those things. That frustration during your training, that's, I think we don't need to complain. We just need to be the change. when we become mentors, when we become seniors, when we become physicians, be good physicians, be helping ones. Be the ones who are good to their juniors, be the ones who are helping for their juniors. So I think this culture of, you know, blaming and crying and everything, it's true to a point, but I think we need to change ourselves. Because if we are changing, the world is changing, hopefully.
Well, a very inspirational message. We were going to ask you just to finally finish with what advice you'd give to trainees, but I think you've probably just covered that in everything you've told us so far.
Yeah. So just to add a few more things in training, one thing is just to talk, to list some important points. Keep up to date with you. It's a must have to be with you. Talk with evidence, talk with data. Don't quote your seniors that this is the right way and this is the wrong way. You should be quoting trials. You should be quoting the figures from the research that is happening. Always respect your seniors. I know it's very difficult when you're going through those periods. I think when you become a senior, then you know the problems you are facing. Like, I was a chief resident at that time, and those of you have been chief residents, you know it's how difficult it is to manage like a lot of people's problems together, because you cannot make everyone happy. So I would say respect your seniors, but you need to be truthful and tell if something is not right. You should just tell Anna a respective manner that, okay, I don't agree with this part of yours, but that should be obviously respectful. It shouldn't be like, you shouldn't look like a boss to your senior. And obviously learning. Don't think people as consumers or customers, basically. And when you go through, I had in 2012, I had an ORIF surgery in my arm. I had a car accident. And when I went through that phase of being a patient, then you are in a totally different world. And a few words from a doctor makes a lot of difference. Your tone, your way of talking, your way of speaking, it makes a lot of difference. Just a few words and the patient feels a totally different way. So I think empathy, sympathy is very important when you're looking at a patient. Consider it as a patient. Consider someone, your loved one, who is going through the same phase. So you have to have some sort of sympathy, not just thinking of them as objects and subjects of a trial. You know, they're human beings. I think that's it. I think I'll take a lot of time just talking about all those things. But yes, just one message would be be the change.
I think that's a final sentence that is perfect. Yeah. Because I think I can speak for Claire that we believe the same. And we are really, really happy and really, really thankful that we could make this happen. And I'm really happy that you came to me in Vienna. And I hope we can establish something bigger together with Pakistan and with other countries as well, to just learn from another and engage and just be the change, as you said.
I think it's just I'm sorry, if I can take just one more minute, I just want to add something.
Sure.
Yeah, go for it.
Yes, thank you. So I was just saying, like, I've never understood this concept of nationalism, to be very honest. And I don't, like, how do you divide humanity between lines? It's something very, it never makes sense to me. Like, we are all humans. When we look at ourselves, we have the same feelings, same attributes, everything is same. But I don't know, it's seeped into us, a lot of it, our nationalistic, you know, the way of looking on each other, that this particular person is from that part of the world and everything. I think what I've seen, I've been to different countries and I've seen people and I've seen everything. I mean, we have the same issues. We have the same emotions. We have the same pain for maybe a dying child or a crying child or a mother. And, you know, everything, I think it's more or less, I think we need to in being the change, I think the one more thing which is very important is to connect ourselves as humans. And I mean, this part of nationalism and those arbitrary boundaries that we have made to, you know, cut humans into different parts, that should be ending now. We should talk about humans.
Another perfect final sentence. Couldn't agree more. I always say that medicine is universal by definition. And even if people tell me that I'm German, I try everything to not be that German. Abdul, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Let's build something together. We obviously keep in touch, and we are really, really happy that you made this happen. And thank you again.